You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Want to join in on the conversation? Call or text 855-75-CIVIC. Now back to Brian and Jamie.
I love that bumper music. It's a little bit of jazz, a little bit of rock, and a whole lot of blues. I love it. Yeah, some Grateful Dead in there. I love that. It's 8:06 right now. If you are joining us this morning, thank you so much for having us on. If you're in Richland Center, you are listening on WRCE, in Hayward on WBZH, and in La Crosse on WLCX. We welcome you all to the program this morning. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. We're glad you're here. This, unfortunately, might not surprise you. It does not really surprise
No.
me. A classified U.S. intelligence assessment completed in February, shortly before the U.S. and Israel launched strikes against Iran, concluded that military action was unlikely to lead to regime change in the country. That report, which was prepared by the National Intelligence Council, determined that neither limited airstrikes nor a larger, prolonged military campaign would likely result in a new government taking power in Iran, even if key leaders were killed. That didn't matter to Benjamin Netanyahu, who then got it to not matter to Donald Trump. And we are in the position we are now. And we had heard that before this was released, we had heard that the intelligence community had said there was no credible threat to the United States. Nothing. Our administration fell back on, well, Iran's been a pain for 47 years. Yes, true. The regime is brutal. Yes, true.
Mm-hmm.
Needs to be removed. True. But why now? That's none of your business. We have reasons. We have our reasons.
Well, I think, too, in this entire process, and let's remind everybody that watching this administration is like a slow-moving avalanche, right? It is the fastest and slowest-moving thing ever. This Iran conflict has been going on now for 10 days. We're 10 days in. We've been watching this war in the Middle East. But it's also like having whiplash all at the same time, right? Because it feels like an eternity ago we were talking about tariffs. We were talking about Greenland. We were talking about all of these different threats, the Supreme Court ruling. And yet here we are 10 days into a conflict with no end in sight. Now, I know the president wants to tell us that, you know, we're close, it's short term, they've been obliterated. I don't actually feel like that's what's happening. And if you're watching what they're saying, the governments in the Middle East are saying, especially Iran, if you are listening to what the president is saying, if you're listening to Marco Rubio or Pete Hegseth, one of these things is not like the other. And I don't see these Middle Eastern countries giving up very easily, especially Iran right now.
Well, the troubling part of this is we had this information.
Yes.
The president chose to ignore it. Because we operate now as a country on what he believes. It doesn't, fact doesn't matter. Experts in the intelligence community writing up these assessments, giving them reports. I don't know if he, you know, supposedly there's daily briefings with the president every day. We don't know if he listens to them. We don't know if he still gets them. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, the administration chose to ignore the people that we have tasked with protecting this country through the intelligence community. And we went ahead and did something that now is going to, he could say it's going to be over in a couple of days as much as he wants. We know how things last over there. We reported at the beginning of the show, Tehran has said they are ready for a long, drawn out conflict.
Yeah.
So this is not going away. And it's infuriating to me that we knew this. We knew this was going to happen. It's exactly as the report said it would be.
And
we did nothing.
There's also been reports that his inner circle, including J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, even Pete Hegseth, were skeptical about going into Iran because of what could be a long, drawn-out conflict. They were skeptical at the beginning and weren't sure that this was the right tactic for this particular government to take. Intelligence officials, though, found that there was really no strong or unified opposition movement inside Iran ready to step in and replace the current government if the leadership collapsed. That assessment predicted that Iran's political and religious establishment would likely move quickly to preserve the existing power structure rather than allow a political vacuum to develop. And what I find fascinating about that is we've had our own experts here on this program who have talked about the fact that they were, if any regime was ready for this type of conflict, it was Iran, who had people 5 and 6, maybe even 7 people deep. So no matter what the president tells you, they've all been taken out. That's not true. It's not true. They have been prepared for this probably more than any regime we've had some experts say probably in the world, because they were always prepared for these types of tactics against them.
And Khamenei's son, yes, you can believe when the president says a lot of people haven't heard him speak. That's true, because
this
he's been
true.
Operating behind the scenes for decades.
Right.
He is well-versed with the Republican Guard over there. He is well-versed with the other clerics. He is ready, and he was ready. And everything that this report said was going to happen has happened. It also stated that there is tension between the administration and the intelligence community because the president dismisses their findings and says they're part of a deep state with a political bias. This is the kind of dangerous and careless behavior that led us to this point.
Right.
And will continue to lead us down a road, I was going to say to destruction, that's a little hyperbolic, but it's going to lead us to a road with very questionable and, I would predict, not pleasant endings.
What I also find fascinating is that when you dig into some of these findings, it raises questions about claims that this conflict could even achieve the objectives, even if they're ever changing from this administration.
I was
going
to say, we don't know what the objectives are, though, right?
Particularly if the expectation was that military pressure might weaken or collapse Iran's leadership, because that's not happening. Now, the Trump administration has given several different explanations for these strikes, saying, obviously, as we know, we've listened to the back and forth, that they were meant to set back Iran's nuclear program or even prevent potential imminent Iranian missile strikes. And attacks. And some administration officials have said that the goal is not regime change. We've heard that. It's come out of several different people. The president, though, has at times suggested that he would like to see different leadership in Iran, creating some confusion about the long-term objective. And what I also think is fascinating is last week, sitting in his office with the German chancellor and asked, you know, what happens if it's somebody worse than Khamenei who comes in? And they were specifically asked about his son. And the president's answer, and I'm paraphrasing here, was that would be bad.
The worst thing would probably be if we did all this and then we got somebody worse. Well, congratulations, that was a little bit of foreshadowing, sir. Because you did, by all accounts, the son is as hardline, if not more hardline than the father, and it's not going well. And then, you know, my favorite quote was he was surprised about Iran's reaction. Oh, did you see? He creates a world in his mind that doesn't really exist. He creates a world where everyone will bow to him, even when he says he wants to be involved in choosing the next leader of Iran. Do you think anybody in Iran is going, oh, we wonder what Donald Trump thinks? No.
No.
They're thinking, these are the people that bombed us. These are the people that killed 160-some children at a girls' school. This is, why would you think anybody cares what you have to say in another country? They don't.
Because here's the weird thing, too, that we have to understand. The dynamics in the Middle East, especially Iran, are not the dynamics we're used to in this country. Because they don't really like, they didn't really like the Ayatollah, most civilians. Mm-hmm. Yet he was what they knew as far as leadership. They don't really know a world without the Ayatollah in charge. So there were some celebrations. Yes, I'm not going to deny that. I'm for sure not shedding tears over the Ayatollah not being in charge and leading a tyrannical government anymore. But at the same time, most of the in the streets that we saw on cameras from Iran after the Ayatollah was killed were not people celebrating Donald Trump and the victory of killing the Ayatollah. They were actually shouting, because it's been translated, death to Donald Trump.
Yes, but he doesn't want to hear that. He doesn't want to hear that. He has Israel telling him, great job, you're winning. You got Hegseth coming out saying, we're doing great. Nobody is giving us enough credit for the wonderful things we are doing. We're glossing over again this decision to ignore the intelligence reports. Right. All he had to do, and all the administration had to do, was listen to the intelligence and go, okay, we've been hunting this guy for a while. Israel really wants him gone. Let Israel handle it. And if Israel, then if there's retaliation and we decide to help, that's fine. But this isn't our fight right now. It might become our fight later, but right now we're just going to keep an eye on Iran. We know the devil we know versus the devil we don't. And now we've got the devil we didn't. And it doesn't look like we know it's not going to change. Now we've stirred the hornet's nest where we have also now become a target, more so than we were before.
I think what troubles me most is, which is part of this ignoring the intelligence report conversation, but the fact that we lean on things like, well, Bibi told me, Bibi recommended we needed to do this. And the fact that this president, instead of listening to career officials who know a thing or two
in your own country,
right, he leans on this small inner circle of thinking. And these are people who critics say don't always have the experience or the qualifications when they're making big decisions, especially this big. And that is a danger to all of us, because career intelligence officials, diplomats, military experts, they exist in our government for a reason. Their job is to essentially analyze information. It's to challenge the assumptions. It's to warn the president or other leaders when something might not go according to plan, which is exactly what was done here. If those voices start getting shut out, like we know this president likes to do and has done in this particular case, if experienced professionals are ignored because these conclusions are just inconvenient to the president of the United States, then these decisions are made in an echo chamber, which is what this is beginning to look like when we're talking about Iran. And history shows us that when that starts to happen, wars become miscalculated, conflicts last multiple years, much longer than they need to, and the consequences are going to ripple across the world, not just in the United States, not just in the Middle East, but across the world. And that is essentially what we're already starting to see play out 10 days into this Middle Eastern conflict.
No end in sight, no matter what we tell. Still no hard and fast reason why we're there. It will continue to be this way, and you are just supposed to listen, believe, and go along with it. And if you're worried about prices, you're an idiot, and that's the way it goes in America today.
It always goes back
to, how exciting.
It always goes back to the believe what you see and hear, not what they're trying to tell you. That's what it always goes back to. You got to believe with your own ears and eyes.
Possible good news for Democrats in the Supreme Court arena here in Wisconsin. We will get to that and more. This is Daybreak. I'm Brian Noonan.
I'm Jamie Martins, and you are listening to the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Solid, better than expected. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:22 right now. Good morning, and thank you so much for joining us today on the Civic Media Network. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. We're glad you're here. This could be good news for Wisconsin Democrats. Announcement came yesterday that State Supreme Court Justice Annette Ziegler will not seek a third term in 2027. She made that announcement yesterday. She said in a statement, quote, "After 3 decades on the bench, now is the right time for me to step away and spend more time with my husband, kids, and grandkids." That's the everybody who retires. They all want, listen, you spend enough time with your family, you go, I wish I was still working. This is crazy. But she is one of the lone conservative, or she's in the conservative minority on the court. So, you know, Jamie, this has to be encouraging news for Democrats, perhaps.
I think so. And if you are a election junkie, probably means yet another election in 2027, maybe 2028. I guess it will depend on how this plays out. But again, she won't be seeking that third term next year. So we'll have to that spot on the Wisconsin Supreme Court will have to be filled. Now, if you don't know much about her, she's got a bachelor's degree in psychology as well as business administration, actually earned a law degree from Marquette University in 1989. She was a private practice attorney as well as a prosecutor until 1997 when then Republican Governor Tommy Thompson appointed her to the Washington County Circuit Court. And then in 2007, she beat attorney Linda Clifford for her seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court in a race that cost about $6 million at the time, Brian. That was a record for a court race. So going all
this
the way 20 years.
I was going to say 20 years. This state has been pumping money into these Supreme Court races forever, and it's just gotten more and more bizarre.
It has.
And more expensive. It every year. It's like, oh,
it's kind of insanity. And if you don't remember,
yes,
it is. It is political insanity. If you don't remember, back in 2008, shortly after Ziegler joined the court, her colleagues actually reprimanded her for handling cases as a circuit court judge involving West Bend Savings Bank. She and her husband, or her husband was a director there at the time, and she is the only justice in state history to be disciplined by her own peers.
Yeah.
Which I think is also fascinating little, would we say blemish? Maybe a blemish on the record, just a little bit.
Yeah, it is. I think if you're the only one ever, that counts as an interesting blemish.
But this is fascinating because we are currently sitting at another election. We already have a Supreme Court election coming up on April 7th between Democrat Judge Chris Taylor and Republican Judge Maria Lazar. By the way, early voting starts March 24th, so get ready for that. But at the same time, we are looking at a court that right now sits in a 4-3. Democrats have a 4-3 majority, getting ready for another election where it feels like maybe Wisconsin, if you look at the latest Marquette polling, is a little complacent this time around. The money pumping into this particular race between Taylor and Lazar is not quite what it was during Schimmel and Crawford way back when. Again, remember our timeline.
This
it
race,
was fast.
Yeah, but this race also wasn't getting the national attention that
it's
that
not.
One did because of Elon Musk's involvement and, you know.
But why?
It taking it to that big level.
I mean, that's my question. Why was he so focused on Crawford and Schimmel just one
because
year ago?
That would have flipped the focus of the court. It would have been more conservative. So that was the thing, because they were trying to, in the wake of the fake electors and the 2020, they wanted the Supreme Court stacked with Republicans so that when the next challenges came, or even if they relitigated like they've done in other states, that they were hoping that the Supreme Court would rule in their favor. So they were trying to buy more decisions by putting more like-minded people on the court, and it didn't work, and that was the big battle. And now we don't feel that pressure this time around, but complacency is a very dangerous thing because the balance of the court can shift any election.
Yeah.
It can shift. And if you go from 4-3 to 5-2, you're a little better off. and you've got a little more breathing room. But yeah, complacency is not an option at this point.
No, absolutely. And I think that's what we're seeing in the recent polling from Marquette. Is not only are we seeing complacency for this Supreme Court race, we're also seeing it across the board with the gubernatorial race, especially on the Democratic side, where right now you have the seven Democrats all vying for the top spot to run against presumably what's going to be Tom Tiffany. He is obviously the Republican front runner. But, you know, I guess I'm a political junkie. So if we're talking another major statewide election, I'm down. I'm ready for another one. I mean, this is what we breathe on, like cheese curds and elections in this state. I mean, what else do we have? This has literally become a state where we have elections almost every single year. It's a lot of elections. I mean, let's be real. This year alone, we have four. We're down to three, but we still have three. We have three to go. We've already had one. So, I guess if we're talking the money in politics, because I'm going to assume that depending on how this race shakes out on April 7th is probably going to dictate how big of a race this potentially is between, Ziegler's Republican replacement and potentially a Democrat replacement. I don't actually mind the more low-key election this time around and the lack of I don't want to say lack of money, because there's plenty of money going into this
money, yeah.
This Supreme Court race as well. But in comparison to last year, there's definitely a lack of money.
But a low-key election is nice. There's still a lot of money. But low-key election scares me, because to me, if there's not a lot of hype and a lot of hoopla, it did lead to bigger numbers in turnout last time. So I fear that low key will translate to low turnout, which is never a good thing in any election. So don't rest on your laurels, folks.
I guess we're about to find out who's got the better grassroots effort. Is it going to be the Democrats or the Republican? Because this one's going to be probably one in the grassroots. It's 8:29 right now. This is Daybreak. I'm Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Perhaps public buy-in to Badger Care. We'll talk about it after this. It's the Civic Media Network.
Local news, community stories, and the conversations that matter most. Now, more Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:35 right now. Thank you so much for joining us on the Civic Media Network. And hey, by the way, good morning. I don't know if I've said that enough today. My name is Jamie Martinson.
I've said it enough. I'm okay. Brian Noonan. No, we're glad you're here. As a result of rising costs for health insurance purchased through the Affordable Care Act, about 20,000 Wisconsin residents did not enroll in Marketplace health insurance this last year. Democrats in the state legislature are proposing another solution to help more people afford health coverage. Representative Tara Johnson from Shelby, she's a Democrat, announced legislation Tuesday. That would enable members of the public to buy into the state's Badger Care Plus health insurance plan. To tell us about this is Christy Tweed. She's with She's the Healthcare Action Coordinator, rather, at Citizen Action Wisconsin. CitizenActionWI.org is the website. Christy, thanks for being here this morning. We appreciate it. So tell us what's in this proposed bill. How is this going to work? What does it entail?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Well, it's basically a four-part plan. So one, it creates a state exchange, which many states have already done. So instead of going to the federal ACA, you would go to a state exchange. You would still have the options to buy into insurance covered plans, but there would also be a state plan, Medicaid or Badger Care plan. So it would expand coverage for those that are currently making, like right now, they qualify at $15,000 a single person. It would expand that, so almost double it. They would be able to make $30,000, and a family of four making $30,000 right now is covered. It would expand it up to a little over $60,000, which we know is still not very much.
Right.
So that would be the basic plan, that it would expand coverage, what we know is Badger Care expansion. And then it would also allow people, other people, entrepreneurs, business owners, people who don't have employee coverage to buy into the plan on a sliding scale and also be able to use the existing ACA subsidies that are no longer that not the ones that got taken away, not the enhanced ones, but the original subsidies. And then lastly, it would open it up to small business owners to buy plans for their employees. So businesses with under 50 employees would now be able to go on the small business marketplace and buy coverage for their employees, which makes them more competitive. We know a lot of businesses are really wanting to be able to provide coverage for their employees.
So, Christy, let's take a quick step back for anybody who's listening today, who maybe has never used BadgerCare, isn't really familiar with BadgerCare. How does this current proposal from the Democrats differ from what is currently available to people?
Sure. Right now, you have to make under a certain amount to qualify for basically free health care under the BadgerCare. BadgerCare is Medicaid. But we know, like I said, a single person making $15,000 a year, that barely covers rent. A lot of people have, first of all, most people on BadgerCare already work. The ones who don't are usually disabled or have issues that cause them to not be able to work. Family of four at $60,000 or at $30,000, who can afford the premiums that are now being thrusted on us, especially after HR1 and the sort of obliteration of the enhanced premium tax credits? And by the way, I prefer tax credits over subsidies because these are tax credits to help mid to low income folks get access to health care, no different than tax breaks that were given to the very wealthy.
Well, they're different. We know that. We don't equate the two. I mentioned at the beginning, 20,000 Wisconsin residents didn't enroll this year. Has there been any estimate of if this bill were to become law, how many people, first of all, how many people are on use BadgerCare now, and what the increase would be if this became a law?
First of all, it's really hard to tell how many people are dropping off or will continue to drop off the ACA because so many people were auto-enrolled and just are now starting to get their bills and realize they can't afford it. So yeah. We know in the country over 1 million people have already dropped off. And we expect that to triple or quadruple. So people are going to get their bills and just not pay them. So they haven't really been registered on that scale yet. The other thing is many people have dropped to a lower plan. So if they were on the gold plan before, now they're on a silver or bronze plan, which unfortunately, you know, those plans have very high deductibles and high copays. So even if people are covered, they're not getting the care they need. They're opting out. We know 52% of Wisconsinites were avoiding or postponing care prior to HR1,
right.
Just because they're afraid of the costs. And we know that, you know, it started a long time ago. The system has been rigged against us for a long time. Greedy insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and hospital monopolies are putting profits over people. That's what's great about this plan is there's no profit involved. It's just at cost. So we know that people will have a lower cost option through this plan.
We're talking with Christy Tweed this morning. She is the healthcare action coordinator at Citizen Action Wisconsin, citizenactionwi.org. Christy, as we talk about these increase in prices and people losing coverage, how would a public option like what's being proposed potentially lower the cost or even give people more choices when they're looking for insurance? Is that possible with this proposal?
Sure. Well, like I said, insurance companies control the cost on the other plans. We're not taking away anyone's options. People can still go on the marketplace and buy from private insurance, but there's a lot of profit built into that. With Medicaid or BadgerCare here in Wisconsin, that price, that cost is already set by the government, and there's no profit involved in it. Also, we can get discounts by buying on a larger scale. So it's already established program. So we don't know exactly what people would pay if they're buying in, but we know definitely that the expansion is going to help the people that are making under the income level we're proposing. But we have to assume that the people buying in on a sliding scale would be much cheaper than the inflated insurance prices that are out there now.
Christy, how's this proposal being commented on by politicians, by the rest of the assembly? What's the vibe on this?
So we have record sort of, it's early yet. We just proposed it the other day, but we have record support in the assembly. I think all but two assembly people have signed on to it. And, you know, we're still in talks with the rest. Several senators have signed on, but that's really the next phase of our campaign, is really just like getting in touch with them and explaining it a little better and trying to garner support. The other thing is, we need to, as people, make our voices louder than, like, say, the Hospital Association, right? Like, yes. So that's an important part of the work that I do, is going around the state, talking to our co-ops, doing town halls, making sure the public's aware, and sending their representatives letters and making phone calls and making sure that they know that the public wants this.
Are any of the gubernatorial candidates piggybacking on this now and using it as campaign fodder?
They are talking about a public option, which is exciting because, you know, Governor Evers put it in the budget last time and it got struck out, and we feel like maybe could have fought a little harder for it. I know it's a complicated process, not dissing on Governor Evers, but we see a lot of the, at least Democrat candidates, talking about some form of a public option. And that's something that we will also be tracking and looking at and holding candidates accountable for too.
A lot of people say that these public programs are going to cost taxpayers more. So let's talk about that for a minute, because as obviously a proponent of this and as this bill, we find out more about it. How do supporters of this proposal respond to the concern that a public program would cost the taxpayers more?
Sure. Well, first of all, we can't do a completely accurate fiscal analysis right now, because the federal regulations haven't even been released on how the expansion and HR 1 is going to work. So it's kind of impossible to compare apples to apples. Also, I would say, so that there may be a little cost involved in this. We initially thought that it would pay for itself. We do know less people will be going to the emergency room, right? If they're uncovered, guess what? They go to the emergency room, and who pays for that? So there probably will be some cost, and we think it's well worth it. The tens of thousands of Wisconsinites that will gain coverage, this is just an urgent need for Wisconsinites. And I say we could look into rolling back some of Scott Walker's tax cuts for the very wealthy to pay for this.
It's probably the same answer that you just gave, without, you know, with this being new and there's no fiscal reports yet. Was there any estimate on what the public buy-in would be premium wise for an individual or a family? You used the individual and the family of four as examples before. Any range where this might fall?
I do not have those numbers. I think that's something that comes, like, this is the basic of the bill.
Sure.
If it gets to, you know, committee and hearings and they start working on it, we'll have better estimates.
Okay.
Excuse me. But I mean, we believe because there's no profit center involved, that it'll be a lower cost option. And I think there's some estimation that where they've done this in other places, that the insurance companies in that area or in the state tend to lower their prices a little bit as well to be competitive.
There you go. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Right.
With the current political climate, obviously we know that the legislature's already gaveled out for the year. The Senate's getting ready to gavel out for another year. So obviously a proposal for expanded health care is going to face some long odds because of the legislature and the fact that the Republicans have chose to take a little time off. Why introduce a bill right now if it won't pass? And what can people do who are listening with just a couple minutes left to make sure that their voices are heard if this is something they feel like needs to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it took a little longer than we planned getting it introduced. But we do feel like they could go back to work, but knowing that that probably isn't going to happen, we just have to look forward to what we can do next cycle, right?
Sure.
So what can we do now to set us up for next cycle? And that is getting involved with organizations like Citizen Action of Wisconsin. We have a lot of partner orgs that we're reaching out to form a coalition behind this. We're doing town halls across the state, press events. We have co-ops throughout the state where you can join our healthcare team. And I actually hold a statewide healthcare team of leaders that work on the ways we can get more people involved and get our voices heard to make sure that they know, legislators know how we feel.
Christy, we appreciate your time today. Christy Tweed is the Healthcare Action Coordinator at Citizen Action Wisconsin. CitizenActionWI.org is where you get all the information. Have a great day.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Wisconsin wakes up here. Back to Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:52 right now. We hope that you are having a great morning. I told Parker one day that I love that music coming back in because it makes me feel like I'm at the end of a 1980s show. You know, like one of those where it had the big end credits and it's a good feeling.
It's Born to Run. Our last segment, we get revved up to hit the door. Not that we don't love spending time with you.
We love spending time here.
We do, but our workday's done. I need to go. First thing I go do is to take my mind off politics for 5 minutes. I let the dogs run crazy on me.
Yes.
And we just we do that. Jamie, when we complain about our job, it's mostly tongue in cheek because we got a pretty good gig.
We do.
But
a lot of people
do not like their jobs. A lot of people complain. Parker's one of them. Oh, nonstop. Yep.
Yeah, can't stand it.
Always. Somehow he's upset with his coworkers. I don't understand it. But anyway, Parker, as bad as you think your job is, imagine spending 11 days in the jungle collecting chimpanzee urine.
Not where I thought that sentence was going.
Of course not. That's why I'm here. That's
gotta
what
keep you on your toes, Parker.
My toes, all right.
There's a job that's probably not worse than the job or is worse than the job you had. This happened in 2025 in Uganda. Aleski Moro is a scientist, and he said the most consistent, predictable time to collect chimpanzee urine is in the morning. Just like people, they have to go when they wake up. He's a PhD student in integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley. And you may be thinking, Brian, why would you talk about chimpanzee urine when we're on our way to work? Because, friends, it's science.
It is science.
And the reason they're doing this, Jamie, is to try to find out if chimpanzees' attraction to fermented fruits that they eat in the jungle ties into human beings' desire to drink alcohol. So it's monkey and man and booze, and it all comes together in one story where I get to say chimpanzee urine. And to me, those are the three keys in picking a good topic.
Well, I love this. I do love a good science, even if we are talking about chimpanzee urine. But yes, chimpanzees appear to consume a fair amount of alcohol when they're eating ripe fermenting fruit, which would make total sense, right?
Yes.
And so Mauro says that this actually tells us a little bit about human evolution. He says in primates, it could be that when, you know, you smell alcohol, that means that that's maybe where the sugars are. So in other words, the scent of fermentation might be a shortcut to a more calorie-dense food. And he was intent on figuring this out. Essentially, the evolutionary origins of human attraction to alcohol. This might say more about Alexi than anybody, but, you know, hey, I'm always down for a good science story. So it turns out that monkeys and apes are not likely consuming enough alcohol to get drunk. Well, that's good, because a bunch of drunk apes running around the jungle would be...
drunk monkeys.
No, that sounds awesome.
That does sound something. Great. Just, I would love an observation deck to watch drunk gorillas go at it. And I'll tell you another thing, Kong. You're shut up. I don't care if you're a silverback. I'll whoop you down.
But they do have an ancient affinity, and their ancient affinity may actually explain why humans are drawn to this stuff to the point of intoxication. Because, as Mauro points out, this could represent a profound, quote, mismatch between the way we live today and the way we evolved.
What I tell Debbie every time. I'm drinking because I've evolved this
way. That's right.
This is not, I can't help my upbringing, my DNA, my entire evolutionary tract.
So a lot of the ripe fruits that, you know, typically make up a chimp diet in Uganda contain a good amount of ethanol. So Mauro really wondered if the animals were actually consuming the alcohol. It turns out of 19 chimps in the study, urine samples of 17 tested positive for ethanol, and at least 10 of those contained a concentration equivalent to humans having at least one or two drinks. Small number to
chimps
say
chimps know how to party.
It's
that's what we've
small
learned from
number
this
to say that this is definitive, but Mauro says that it's tantalizing. That would totally be a word that a guy who does this would use. Tantalizing. Talking about chimp urine.
Listen, monkeys who get hammered, that is tantalizing. That's a story I need to figure it out.
I just love that in this day and age, we can still use science to prove that humans and monkeys and still have some sort of connective tissue running through them. And
yes,
that even if monkeys are eating fermented fruit in the wild to get hammered, that means that, well, we're going to have an affinity for alcohol, too.
I would take a chimp out for a mango margarita.
That
would be, you know, we'd both get some fermented fruit. It is interesting, though. This sounds like a guy, and I love crazy scientific studies because you're like, where did this idea come from? He probably got yelled at for getting drunk one night by his partner, and he said, you know what? It's like I can't help it. I smell this alcohol, and I just want to there has to be some ancient link.
Right.
And now he is out to prove it, and it seems promising. Yeah, well, it's tantalizing.
What I love about this is he says the next step in his research will essentially be determining whether these chimps are actively seeking out the fruits that contain ethanol or just consuming it by mistake. Yep, that's what I say every time I do.
Yeah.
I just consumed that one by mistake. That one just
Where'd that
got
bottle
my
of
hand.
Bourbon go? I don't know. I was having some bananas, walking around the jungle, and it just... it's gone by accident.
I don't know.
I'm just a monkey.
I feel like these are plausible excuses to get us all through life from here on out. And if,
thank
again,
God,
we could blame it all on science. And I feel like that's
right.
A win-win for all of us. See, this is what science actually gets us, Brian.
So you're welcome, folks. If you were going out for a happy hour today and you're afraid you're going to get yelled at when you get home, you're welcome. It's
right.
A connection to our primal past.
That's right.
So there you go.
That's the excuse you're going to use. Use it.
I'm going to go have a mimosa right now.
Oh, I think
that's
a good
breakfast
lovely.
Drink fruit.
Put a banana in it, though. Get more fruit in there. More fermentation. It's 8:59 right now. You are listening to Daybreak. Thank you so much for joining us. I am Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Have a great day. We will talk to you again tomorrow right here on the Civic Media Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.